It's great to be back at Perimeter. Some of you, well, I recognize many faces. For those who were not here 3 years ago, I was faculty at Perimeter Institute until 3 years ago. I had been in the building for 8 years before that. The work that I want to present today is what I've done for the first 2.5 years since I left. So I'm currently in the Quantum Google Quantum AI team in Santa Barbara, building, or it's been recorded, yeah, building a quantum computer. So the work I'll describe corresponds to what I did as part of X or Google X, and it was about using tensor processing units. I'll tell you what those are, as scientific supercomputers. Okay, so a summary of the whole talk is super simple. We repurposed Google's tensor processing units, TPUs, which were designed for machine learning. We repurposed them as supercomputers for a number of tasks, computational tasks, that you would be interested outside machine learning, including linear algebra. And the point here is not to do something new, but to do something faster and at scale. In particular, we didn't invent matrix multiplication. People knew how to multiply matrices before, but now we can do that at scale, meaning multiplying, say, two big matrices. Each one is a million times a million coefficients, and you can get them multiplied in, say, 2 minutes. Or we also applied TPUs to quantum computer simulations, so to simulate the quantum computer that Google is building. To quantum physics, say a spin chain. In this case, we can deal with, say, 40 qubits or 40 spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. That is 1 trillion complex amplitudes. We also applied TPUs to progressing, to advancing the quantum chemistry computations, specifically density functional theory. We ended up performing the world largest density functional theory computation with 250,000 orbitals. I'll explain what that is later. We also apply this to tensor networks. For those who know about tensor networks such as matrix product states or DMRG, we managed to also get the world largest calculation with 65,000, bond dimension 65,000. We had also applications to finance, and that was a lot of fun. We wrote a number of papers. But the group was closed, so you know, we got all fired because we were not we were too academic, I guess. In any way, before that happened or after that happened, but while we still had data, we managed to write a number of papers describing all these results, and so you have a list here, which includes applications to quantum many-body physics, the first two, distributed linear algebra, quantum chemistry, applications to quantum computing, density metric renormalization group, and so on. Okay, so we managed to get some papers out there. So this is the team that I work with for about 2+ years, and some of you may recognize that actually Martin was a postdoc at Perimeter before joining us, Marcus was a PhD student at Perimeter before joining us, and Adam was a postdoc at Perimeter before joining us. So this, we function, you know, I get lots of questions, how is working in industry? Well, we actually didn't realize we were working in industry, we just had a normal research team. Ryan, Rui, and Johnny are PhD students at UC Irvine and Duke University. And basically, from this side towards the left, this was just a regular research team, just working in a place with no individual offices and free food all day. On the other hand, we had a number of other roles there. We had a product manager, strategy and partnerships person, and so on, engineering lead, the director. That was more like different from working in academia. All right, and so Yeah, the team was closed in December of last year. So what is this about and why I think it's interesting to talk about the results? So our starting point was this thing that is known that is happening in machine learning, and there are local experts in machine learning and artificial intelligence. So over the last 5-10 years, there has been this kind of arms race to build in industry to build the most powerful machine learning computers, or computers that are designed exclusively to accelerate and scale up machine learning workloads. Okay, so every year they double or triple capacity, and that's been happening for the last several years. And so what we were wondering is, okay, what makes this ASICs, these application-specific integrated circuits, what makes them useful for machine learning? And the hypothesis was that perhaps if we understood the computational building blocks that were powering machine learning, maybe we could reuse the same chips for the type of calculations that we were used to doing in more non-machine learning scientific context. Okay, so the question we wanted to ask is, given that that compute power is already there, it's very specialized, right? It's only for machine learning, but what if we manage to repurpose it for other scientific tasks? Okay, that was the hypothesis. And we did that with our experiments were with so-called TPU version 3 pod. So a pod of TPUs. I'll tell you what the TPU is in a minute. But in this picture, what you see is a full pod. A full pod consists of 2048 cores. Each core you can think of a basic, a pretty powerful already computer, but we are going to connect 2048 of those together. Operating at the 100 plus petaflop scale, that's a lot of flops. And with 32 terabytes of high bandwidth memory, that's memory already close to the cores. And to give you an idea, this allows you to store the wave function of 40 qubits, right? So 2 to the 40 coefficients, which I never remember how much that is, but I think it's a trillion complex coefficients. So you can keep that in memory close to the processing units and make really big things happen. So that's the technology we used. In the meantime, there is already TPU V4 out there, and the capabilities have improved very significantly. We did not use those machines though. Okay, so those, as I said before, these machines were designed exclusively for machine learning, and that means that compared to a CPU, you throw away everything that does not go into training or inference in a machine learning workload. You throw everything away and just focus on what you need for that particular task. But it turns out that includes matrix multiplications. And when we saw that, we thought, okay, that's it, matrix multiplications. Let's rethink all the algorithms that we are familiar with just purely in terms of matrix multiplications and see how far we can get. Okay, that was the strategy. Can we just, suppose you have a matrix and you want to compute the eigenvalue decomposition. Usually there are methods to do that that are not based on matrix multiplication. But there are alternative methods that you could use, come up with, knowing that matrix multiplications are cheap, right? That would get you to the same outcome. And so that's what we did. We tried to reformulate everything we knew in terms of matrix multiplications. And so as I said, that implies being able to rewrite a number of tasks of dense linear algebra, simulations of quantum computers, quantum physics, quantum chemistry, and finance. All right, so TPUs, what do we need to know about the TPU, right? I can tell you the two things that I learned about TPUs. The first one is that a single core, single TPU core, is a very exotic piece of hardware in that, in particular, it has a unit called matrix multiply unit, MXU. This is a unit, a piece of hardware that has the shape of a matrix, okay? It has the shape of 128 times 128 matrix. So you put your 128 times 128 matrix there, and then you get another matrix to go through, and they get multiplied at the level of hardware. This is not you know, typically a CPU will get numbers one by one, multiply numbers, add them, so on, right? This piece of hardware was designed to multiply matrices, and it's the only thing that can do. Okay, so each CPU core comes with, in this case, two matrix multiply units that can multiply matrices of size 128 times 128 natively. And then next to that MXU, you have 16 gigabytes of high bandwidth memory. So to give you an example of, or basically what that means in practice is, and this is a radical, you know, simplification of the what a TPU can do, but it's all we need to know for this presentation. So the net result is that we can accelerate, or we can apply matrix-matrix multiplications very, very fast. And very, very fast means 10 teraflops of single precision matmuls. With this bandwidth, high bandwidth memory, we can store, say, matrices that are 16,000 times 32,000. So, you know, this is comparable to maybe what you can put in your laptop, okay? But that's just one of those, one core. And it will multiply them maybe 100 times faster than, or 1,000 times faster than your laptop.
Sorry. What is flop?
Floating point operations. Oh. It's a measure of how much compute you get done. And yeah, if I say 10 teraflops or something, just think a lot. No, I'll be more concrete about a comparison you know, of these machines with CPUs, regular computers that you might be more familiar with in a minute. Okay, so point number one then is that each core can multiply matrices very fast. Okay. Point number two about TPUs, represented here, is that we can connect two cores directly with each other using a fast intercore interconnect. What that means is that compared to other accelerators where you would have an accelerator which is controlled by CPU and you have to move data from CPU to the accelerator or from the RAM to the accelerator back and forth, with TPUs you can put your data in the accelerator and the accelerator can share it with other cores of the, right? You have many accelerators there and the accelerators can talk to each other directly without going through the CPU. Which means much, much faster compute. So point number two then is this connectivity. The basic TPU unit, instead of being one core, it's directly 8 cores connected to nearest neighbor in a torus topology. And what happens is that you don't stop at 8. You could decide to use, say, 32 cores or all the way to 2048 cores, where all these cores talk to each other again. Through nearest neighbors in a 2D grid with torus topology. Okay, so you basically you put your data there, okay, and that's a lot of data. The total memory was did I say 16? I don't remember anymore. So the total memory was for these machines were 32 terabytes. And then you have 32 terabytes worth of data there that you can process at the speed of light, right? So, right. And thanks to the fact that the cores are connected directly with each other, what you can see is the compute, the computation scales very nicely. For instance, with thousands of cores, you can get that each core is performing at about 93 to 95% of how much a single core could perform by itself. Okay, you lose a little bit with putting the cores together. There is a bit of time lost in communication, but you still get 93 to 95% of usage of each core, as if each core was it's being occupied or busy this amount of time. All right, so here's the comparison. If you want to understand what happens in practice when you try to use these machines for matrix multiplication, and later I'll explain what you can do with matrix multiplications, of course. But if you want to see what happens when you try to multiply matrices, we run a number of experiments. You know, when you get hardware access to hardware, they'll tell you whatever story they want about how wonderful it is, but we really wanted to benchmark it. since this was the basis for all our subsequent work. And so this is a plot and experimental data from using the hardware where we're going to multiply two large matrices. Okay, the x-axis tells n is the linear size of a matrix. So 10 to the 3 means our matrices are 1,000 times 1,000. Okay, you take two matrices 1,000 times 1,000 and you multiply them. Okay, all the way to 1,000,000 times 1,000,000. So you can try this on your laptop. You don't want to try this on your laptop. Okay, and the vertical axis tells us teraflops, how many operations are being performed. It tells us about the speed of the computation. Okay, so teraflops all the way 10 to the 4 up there, starting with 0.1 teraflops. And so the comparison in order to compare this hardware to standard hardware, we had to go to Google Cloud and look for CPU machines with the largest possible amount of memory, because we needed to store these large matrices. And so there had some machine called Ultra Memory, I guess, which runs on 208 CPU cores. That's the largest machine we could find in terms of memory. And we started using the CPUs to multiply ever larger matrices. And we could see that the larger the matrices, the more teraflops we are getting until we reach saturation. And then at that point we stop, because that was really, really expensive in terms of renting the machines. Okay, but once you reach here, you assume that it won't go down, it stays the same. So that was with 208 CPU cores. And then for comparison, a single GPU, graphic processing unit, an 800 from NVIDIA, could perform a double the amount of teraflops, right? So this tells you a GPU is extremely powerful, can perform better than this very large CPU machine. But then what we did was we started using TPUs, and in blue you have the performance for 8 cores. And then in yellow you can see the performance for, I think, 32 cores, 128 cores in green, and 512 in red, and finally 2048 cores in purple. And the net result is this, that if we look at how fast the TPUs would multiply two very large matrices, 1,000,000 times 1,000,000, then we see that TPUs can finish the task 2,000 times faster than CPUs, okay, than this particular choice of CPUs. So 2,000 times faster. Okay, you can now say, oh, what about putting more CPUs? Yeah, you can always go around, but you get the idea, right? 2,000 times faster is three orders of magnitude faster. That's one point. But then, of course, if you use very specialized hardware, you may think, well, sure, you pay more, you get, you know, faster results. But actually, when you look at the end-to-end cost of renting those machines, the TPUs versus the CPUs, since TPUs are so much faster, even though they might be more expensive, at the end of the day, we got the results with TPUs came out 50 times cheaper. Okay, and again, you could change the numbers a little bit, but you get an order of magnitude. So this is not just hardware that, because it's super specialized, can perform better. It's that actually the end-to-end cost of performing such calculations is very significantly cheaper. Okay, and so, you know, if I was selling something here, I would stress the price, but I'm not selling anything. This was an experiment we did to make a point. And again, the point is that there is a new generation of hardware that has, you know, I'm talking about TPUs, but there are also GPUs from NVIDIA that perform similarly. And this hardware is available. It's available online. Everybody can access it, okay? You need a credit card, yeah. But it's not like, you know, compare this to trying to book time in Summit Supercomputer in Oak Ridge or something, right? You need to have the proper friends, then you need to write a proposal. Research proposal, it will be discussed by people who may not know what you are trying to do. And eventually one day you say, oh, you have, you know, this time allocation, right? Well, here, this is always available. This is for machine learning in principle. So, and it's very popular. So, you know, there is a competition between, I don't know, AWS, Google, IBM, Microsoft, whoever. There is strong competition. So that hardware has been made easily available to everyone, right? And it actually performs much better than the hardware we're used to for certain tasks. Okay? No, this is not general purpose computing. This is, in this case, a large matrix multiplication. Okay, so that was basically the message. I think it's good to be aware of that.
Can you explain a little bit what does it mean for this to saturate? Is it I have to serialize the operations after?
So this one, when you saturate, it means that you are utilizing all the cores that you have.
So then after that point, then my only hope is to serialize the process. So I have to be one shot and then.
Right. So a limiting factor, the reason why we jump from TPU configuration to TPU configuration is that we saturated the high bandwidth memory. The matrices were so large that we needed to add more accelerators that each one comes with memory to be able to store larger matrices in. So in this, the compute these machines are so efficient at computing that the bottleneck ends up being memory. Not compute time, even though the memory scales as n squared and the compute time as n to the third power. So it should be, you know, compute time should be the bottleneck, but it ends up being the memory.
This kind of comparison is compare TPU with CPU. How about GPU?
GPU is here. One GPU is here.
Like the price and the speed.
I don't know. The answer is I don't know. But I will talk more about GPUs in a minute. So I'm guessing GPUs are same order of magnitude as TPUs. And also, well, yeah. I mean the prices oscillate every day, so it's hard to know. But I would say it's comparable. So most of the things I'm saying about TPUs. I talk about TPUs because that's the experiment we conducted. But there is nothing fundamental today. I'll explain why today. When we started, GPUs were not there. But in the meantime, they have become similarly scalable. So I think that's actually the next slide. Yes. So this is a busy slide. I just wanted to say that, you know, here we have performance in flops. Here we have memory, high bandwidth memory. And this sequence of increasing number of TPU cores says that we can scale up big time, okay? When we conducted these experiments, GPUs are somewhere, you know, it's not clear whether you should compare one core, one GPU to one TPU or eight TPUs to one GPU. It really depends on the prices and number of factors. But the point was that back then, the largest configuration of TPUs that you could have connected core to core with NVLinks, so comparable to the TPU connectivity, was stopped at eight GPUs. So you could access eight GPUs that were connected with each other through NVLinks. Okay, and that was the largest configuration. But sometime in March, I think, NVIDIA said, okay, let's stop that. Let's go, you know, crazy. And they now have these GPU configurations, which are pods of DGX nodes, for those of you who know about this. So a DGX node would be 800s. Later on, it's going to be H100, so Hopper 100. But anyway, instead, now what they have is they connected these nodes, they connected them with NVLinks. So fast interconnects between nodes of GPUs. Okay. So now, I don't know, I couldn't be bothered to update this plot. GPUs could be anywhere up there. Okay, so whatever advantage TPUs had when we started this experiment 2 years ago, in terms of scalability, it's gone. GPUs can get you there as well. Okay? Now the question is, how do you access those GPUs? And that's still not clear. To the best of my knowledge, I cannot go to cloud and get access to any GPU configuration beyond 800s, but I think that's just a matter of time. In 6 months, this may have changed completely. Okay, but the hardware is there; everybody can access it, and that's maybe the main message here. That this should probably affect how you plan to, you know, how you think about computing for certain computational tasks, scientific computational tasks. You should know that there is a shift in impossibilities.
So is there any export control on TPUs?
TPUs are not being sold. You can only access them externally. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm assuming that anybody with a good credit card can access them. All right, so blah, blah, blah. But let's talk a little bit about how to perform matrix multiplication at scale with TPUs. And again, what I say about TPUs could translate in a clean way to GPUs as well. So what we want to do is, or what we could do, what we implemented were two types of matrix multiplications, matrix multiplication. The first type is take a very large square matrix, take another one, multiply them. And the second type is where second type of matrix multiplication is where you take a smaller matrix, and then a matrix which is rectangular, one size is the same as the first one, and the other size you go crazy, you just saturate your memory. Okay, so this would be, I don't know, 10 billion times 100, whereas this one is a million times a million. And the strategy is straightforward. Oh, sorry, let me tell you first what we did with these two types of matrices. So with the large square ones, an example of application would be to do the quantum chemistry calculations of the DFT flavor, so density functional theory. This could store the Hamiltonian of your quantum chemistry calculation, and by multiplying them, we can solve this quantum chemistry problem. So applications are densely linear algebras, so we applied matrix polynomials, matrix decompositions, such as eigenvalue decomposition or singular value decomposition, and then applications to quantum chemistry and to finance. The other type of matrix multiplication is the one that we use to store a wave function of say n qubits for n equal to 40. So this guy is going to be a 40 qubit wave function, and then we will update it under the action of a 2-qubit gate or 3-qubit gate or a local Hamiltonian, okay? And we use that to simulate quantum computations and also to simulate quantum many-body physics, spin change, and so on. So, this was, the basic operations that we implemented. And then how to implement those, it's just a comment here that actually, after you manage to understand how the hardware works and learn a lot of new things, if you are coming from, say, another field, you realize that it's not so hard. At the end of the day, what you do is you take the matrices, you break them into pieces, and you distribute each piece in a different core. You bring each piece here into a different core. Remember that the TPU cores are connected in a two-dimensional grid, and you just broke the matrix in a two-dimensional grid, and so it's a one-to-one mapping. This part is straightforward. These cores were connected so that they could apply matrix multiplications. Okay, so it's not a surprise. It's not a surprise that it's a good match. So you distribute one matrix, you distribute the other, and in order to multiply them, there are well-understood algorithms such as SUMA, where you locally multiply pieces of matrices and then communicate information to nearest neighbors. You can find this algorithm on Wikipedia. It's not a secret. All right. And for the other type of matrix multiplication, the distribution work slightly different. You would have a copy of the small matrix on each of the cores and then have purely a local matrix multiplication on each core. It is a bit more complicated than that, but for those who may want to learn more about this, we use JAX, the JAX library, which is Python-like library. There is a just-in-time compiler from Python to HLO, high-level operations, and then the XLA compiler maps the high-level operations into low-level operations. There is a lot more of information if anybody is interested. And there are a number of constraints when you use very highly specialized hardware. It turns out that there are little things about the hardware that you need to know. If you just go blindly in, bad things happen to you. For instance, remember I told you that the matrix multipl- MXU, matrix multiply unit, was 128 times 128. So here's how a TPU multiplies, say, two matrices of size 10 times 10. Okay, takes one matrix, 10 times 10. It pads it with zeros until it's 128 times 128. Takes the other matrix, does the same to it, and then it multiplies the two matrices. So most of the compute time goes into multiplying zero times something. Okay, it will take as much time to multiply two small matrices as the time it would take to multiply 128 times 128 matrices. So you need to know these things. If your matrix is 129 times 129, you are in trouble because it will take twice the time, okay? Or in this case, 8 times the time. All right, so you need to learn these things, and then you also need to learn to program under the single instruction multiple data paradigm, which means that you have to instruct all the cores to do exactly the same on different data. So it's not like, oh, I have 2048 cores. This one is going to do this. This one is going to do that. No. They don't want to know. They just want single piece of code that will apply exactly the same to every single core. And then what changes is the data that you fit on each core. For instance, the pieces of the matrices, the piece of matrix that you fit in one core is going to be different than the piece of matrix that you fit in another core. But it will process, each core will process the information in exactly the same way. All right. So the question then is, okay, big deal, we can multiply matrices, large matrices very fast. So what do we do with this? Okay. Those of you who are used to trying to simulate maybe quantum computers will clearly know the answer. One thing you can do is quantum computing, simulations of quantum computers. But what we wanted to do is to take a step back and really try to rephrase as much linear algebra, basic linear algebra as possible in terms of matrix multiplications. And so what can we do with matrix multiplications? It turns out that we can do a lot of things. It turns out that if you can multiply two matrices, then and you can also add matrices, matrix multiplication plus matrix addition allows you to build polynomials with your matrix. And it turns out that if you can, given a matrix, produce a polynomial of that matrix, there are lots and lots of things you can do. Okay, and examples of that would be a polar decomposition. So I give you a matrix as an input, and the output is going to be a unitary matrix plus a positive semi-definite matrix, such that when you multiply them, u times rho gives you back the matrix you had. It's called polar decomposition in the same way that if you had a complex number, you may want to write it as a complex phase times a positive semi-definite number. Okay, so the same way that you can polar decompose a complex number, you can polar decompose a matrix. And it turns out that if you can apply a polar decomposition to your matrix, then there are lots of other applications that automatically you have access to. In particular, something like the sine function. The sine function is a function, or the sine function of a matrix looks directly into the eigenvalues of the matrix and replaces positive eigenvalues by ones and negative eigenvalues by minus ones. And that's something that you can do without ever computing the eigenvalue decomposition of the matrix. Okay, just through a polar decomposition of some related matrix, you can get the sine function or the inverse square root. So it turns out that similarly, given a matrix, you want to compute the 1 over the square root of that matrix, you can do it just with matrix polynomials. And all the way to a single value decomposition. And the point is that when we understood this, we realized that that's really all that is needed for quantum chemistry calculations, density functional theory calculations for electronic structure. Okay, so first we can do matrix multiplications, then we upgrade to matrix polynomials, then we upgrade it to polar decomposition, and from there we get all the linear algebra that is needed to solve density functional theory problems. So just a little bit more detail on that. What do I mean by we can solve the polar decomposition? So it's as simple as this. Imagine that they give you a matrix M, okay? What do you have to do? You take that as the input for a Newton-Schultz iteration So this was all in the literature. You just needed to go and find it, because people usually would not implement things this way. On a regular PC or on a laptop, there are much faster ways of doing things, right? But they won't scale. Okay. So, but we didn't discover any new piece of mathematics or applied mathematics or anything. It was already in the literature. You just had to find, you know, hidden papers. All right, so you take your matrix, you can square it, subtract, or take 3 times identity minus the square of the matrix, multiply it times the matrix again, divide by 2, and that defines the new step in your iteration. And you do that 10 times, 15 times, 20 times, and that gives you the unitary factor of the polar decomposition. Okay? Turns out that that's as simple as this, that you know, it's a small matrix polynomial iteration. And so we implemented that, and it worked. And similarly, the sine function and the inverse square root. And just to give you an idea of how crazy this can get, if you can, this in this example, starting with a matrix multiplication, we ended up with a singular valley decomposition, just through a sequence, a composition of building blocks that all of them reduce to matrix multiplications. Okay, with matrix multiplication, we can apply a polar decomposition, then a block eigenvalue decomposition into positive and negative subspaces. Then we can eigenvalue. Okay. Then we can use that iteratively, or yeah, to end up with an eigenvalue decomposition, and finally a singular value. So it's a bit more detailed than this, but basically, you know, that slide, it's a bit busy, but it contains the type of all the complexity involved in accomplishing this. So it's not impossible. All right, and then, you know, it's time to present data and see how things perform. And there were no surprises. So this part was a bit boring, right? So everything scaled nicely. We presented the results in this article. And what you can see in these plots is, again, for different computational tasks, such as the matrix multiplication that we discussed before, but also a so-called QR decomposition, which we needed for tensor network algorithms, or solving linear systems, or again, the polar decomposition I just mentioned. For each of these tasks, what we did was, as a function of the size of the matrices, we look at time to solution. Okay, and what you could see there is that all these tasks are n to the third power. They scale as the third power of the linear size of the matrix. And so for any, if you pick a color, you'll see that this is, say, blue, this is n cubed, okay? But what you could do is, every time things become too slow, you just put more cores into it, right? And the number of cores scaling, every time you double the matrix size, you could put 4 times more cores. It should take 8 times the time, it's 2^3, but you put 4 times more cores, so you end up with linear scaling. Okay, the time scales linearly just because you throw in more cores. Okay, so for all these tasks, we ended up having linear time to solution by just scaling up the number of cores. And so at that point, we were dealing with million times a million matrices for all these tasks. Okay, so that was, you know, that's maybe the until now what you might be more familiar with if you deal with linear algebra. And the message was this, that these computational resources are available and allow us to do dense linear algebra at a scale two orders of magnitude larger matrices than we're used to.
QR is also the main algorithm behind full diagonalization, right? So if you just want to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, you get the full spectrum, isn't that QR decomposition? And then you diagonalize the tridiagonal.
That is true. So a typical eigenvalue decomposition could be rooted in this way, but there are a number of steps that require special attention. And TPUs are not good at, if that happens to that, no? They just won't. So we, before the team was shut down, we were, you know, we managed to get the QR up and running, but that was one of the last things we succeeded. And so we couldn't, we we are not in a position to say that we can build a full eigen solver based on QR. It's probably possible.
Can you go back to the plot conversion?
Which one?
Just the previous one. For the matrix multiplication. So in matrix multiplication, you said that as soon as you go above a power of two, even by just one, you have to like make use of the next size of the grid, right? And so is that the zigzag that you're seeing in those plots?
Matrix multiplication?
Yeah.
Where is the zigzag?
Like, so what I understood was that between n, that is between two different powers of two, you would essentially see no difference in the runtime, right? Because it would still...
That was for small matrices. The basic matrix multiply unit is this systolic array that is 128 times 128. That one you have to be very careful with, because if your matrix is a bit smaller than that, you will have to use it many, many times. So you want to aim at having matrices that are 128 times 128. For instance, an implication of that is that when we use TPUs for the simulation of quantum circuits, instead of applying single qubit or two qubit gates to our wave function, we apply seven qubit gates. So we join together two qubit gates until we get a massively large seven qubit gates. Why seven qubits? Well, 2 to the 7 is 128, right? So this hardware works best when you want to update your wave function under the action of seven qubit gates. You want to match the smallest dimensions that you want to multiply. You want to match with the size of the hardware.
Okay. And is that how you're choosing your data points on the x-axis then?
We are doubling the size in this case. Yes.
Thank you. That was just a simple thing. So you do the 1/√ of the matrix, you're saying. Does that mean you have the inverse of the matrix? Just trying to interpret.
You could also have the inverse of a matrix. It will be another polynomial iteration. Sorry?
Just one more multiplication.
Oh, yeah, you could square that. But there is a direct root to that as well.
Sorry, I'm very curious though, like what is that in the matrix multiplication, what is that like decrease first in the yellow curve and then it increases?
All this mess here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this has to do with using a large number of cores for a small matrix multiplication. Since we're gonna distribute the data, remember each core has to be doing the same. You cannot, if you want to use lots of cores, you'll have to break your matrix into small pieces so that every core is doing exactly the same on different data. And so what you're doing is wasting resources because you didn't need that many cores. Each core is not being utilized properly. A lot of time is wasted in communicating between the cores.
So I just assumed that you would expect to see that happen, that dip happen like periodically in the entire curve and not just early on.
So this is the limit of small matrices, starting with 1,000 times 1,000 here, right? So not so small, but for relatively small matrices, if you use, say, 2048 cores in black, you realize that you are really wasting resources because you could get the same performance with just 8 cores, which is the blue line. The spectacular part is here. Is when you go in the limit to the limit of very large matrices, then this is, it's not clear from the plot, but this is log-log, but this is linear scaling, meaning multiplying two matrices scales as n cube, but by throwing in enough cores, and thanks to the scalability and how the cores talk to each other, you end up with a solution that scales, the time scales only as n, not n cube. Okay, so quantum chemistry. The story here is that, how are we doing, 10 minutes?
Sure.
Okay, we'll finish soon. So the story here is that I spent over 20 years as a physicist thinking, chemist, you know, they cannot do physics. And then for the last 3 years, I learned a lot of quantum chemistry, and I have to say that it's an amazing field. It's and it, this has been recorded again. So, but in terms of applications, practical applications, quantum, you know, in the industry relevant applications, quantum chemistry is really much richer than what I'm used to. And you could, if you can solve molecules, and by solving molecules, here I mean if you can access the ground state of the electronic cloud of that you have in a molecule, right? You have, you can, to some approximation, you can imagine that the atoms or the nuclei sit in well-defined places and can be thought of as a classical degree of freedom. And then you have the electrons that are being shared, and they are all over the place. So that's the quantum mechanical description that we need, right, for the cloud of electrons. So the problem we were interested in is finding out the ground state of the electron cloud. Okay? That's the type of questions that will give you a lot of insight into the properties of molecules and material science, and then that is relevant to, you know, both for fundamental research, but also for applications such as batteries and solar cells and chips, building catalysts, and a number of other applications to design drugs and so on. Okay. And well, there are lots of skills there, but we're running out of time. To our surprise, when we started looking at computational methods for quantum chemistry, there are lots of them. That's not a surprise. The surprise is that if you look at all the methods that are out there, most of them have a bottleneck, which can be described as a massive matrix multiplication. Okay, that's what you know, prevents those methods from scaling. And for instance, on the simplest, the simplest quantum methods for quantum chemistry are mean field approximations, density functional theory, where with the number of orbitals that you are going to use to describe your molecule, the cost is going to be n cubed. Basically, you will build a free Fermion Hamiltonian that is going to be n times n for n orbitals, and you'll try to diagonalize that matrix. Okay? That's basically what how this works. But then you can go all the way to methods such as full configurational interaction, where you really want to describe the full wave function of n orbitals, and that scales exponentially with n. There are lots of methods in between. The good news for us was that all these methods, really the bottleneck is matrix multiplication. So we develop TPU versions for all of this. Now I'm not going to give you a crash course on quantum chemistry. But again, yeah, what we realize is that, for instance, DFT, in density functional theory, the tasks that you have to perform are just two. And it's an iteration involving two tasks. Given a molecule described by n orbitals, the task one is build a Hamiltonian for these n orbitals, and that can come with a cost between n and n squared, depending on locality and number of approximations that you want to make. And then there is a density matrix purification step, which says take this matrix, n times n matrix as an input, and produce a related matrix as an output. And that scales as n cubed. Okay? So density functional theory, for people who don't work with that, can be summarized as produce some matrix and apply an n-cube transformation to that matrix, and then feed that back into to produce the next n times n matrix. Okay? And you have to do that back and forth a number of times, say 20 times, and that gives you a free self-consistent field approximation to the ground state of the electronic cloud for your molecule. And it turns out that, well, we were in a hurry. We could not be bothered to accelerate the n part or n squared part. We just used TPUs to accelerate the n cubed part. Okay, and then we could do that at scale, and to 500,000 orbitals. For the largest end-to-end calculation we performed was 250,000 orbitals. The n cubed scaling that we expect, if we don't change the number of cores, versus the n scaling that we expect by upgrading or putting more cores as we try to scale up, there were no surprises. And so what we found in the end, so there is a paper, if anybody's interested, describing all the results. What we found is that the NQ part of the algorithm was no longer the bottleneck. The bottleneck was preparing the Hamiltonian on the CPUs and communicating the result, okay? But that time, the same week that we got to the world record of these calculations, the team was shut down. And so it was, you know, we started very strong that week celebrating, and then we stopped celebrating at some point. Anyway, some information about the previous world record, some details on the calculation, but we don't have time. I think I'm just going to stop here. We have applied this to also full proteins. So traditionally, in quantum chemistry or for drug discovery, you had to be very careful which part of your protein you wanted to deal with at the quantum level, because you know the cost of that calculation was a blocker. And now we've managed to run simulations, quantum chemistry simulations, with or density functional theory calculations on full molecules, full proteins, including the solvent, which is a big deal. These proteins live in water. And if you remove the water from the proteins and you just make a calculation without the water, you get some completely different results about the properties of the protein. So you need to include the water. And it's a waste, right? Because the amount of molecules of water here is such that most of the orbitals go into the water. Okay, that has traditionally been another bottleneck, but now we managed to compute, to run calculations, including all the solvent. And that's it. Just for the experts, the MRG calculations, I can talk about this later on more if anybody's interested. So here's the result. The summary of the talk, sorry, once more, that we managed to repurpose these TPUs that were exclusively designed to accelerate machine learning. We understood what the, you know, the computational building block that accelerated machine learning was, and it was clear then that we could repurpose those machines as scientific supercomputers for a number of tasks that I briefly described today. And papers, and that's it. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, John.
What kind of numbers are these matrices? Like how many bits of precision?
They are quaternions. They are single precision.
Is it 8-bit? Some of these earlier
views. Oh, I see. No. Right. So your question refers, yeah. So, very good. So TPUs were designed to work natively with half precision. But if you use the MXU six times, so the story is that the MXU, the matrix multiply unit, multiplies natively in half precision, but accumulate the result in single precision, if that means anything to you, right? So you are summing numbers. The numbers are the result of multiplying pairs of numbers. They are multiplied in half precision, but you add them in single precision, so that when you add lots of them, you don't get extra errors. Now, that was what was needed for machine learning. But it turns out that if you accumulate in single precision, then there is a trick to use the MXU six times, such that the net result is single precision matrix multiplication. So most of the results I presented were with single precision. Now you can upgrade that to double precision by using the MXU 11 times more than for single precision, at which point you lose a lot, right? The factor 11 in performance to go from single to double precision is a problem. But you can still do that. And for quantum chemistry applications where you expect double precision results, we use, remember this DFT iteration that we had to do back and forth? We did most of it in single precision and only upgrade to double precision the last couple of iterations. And that turned out to be enough to deliver final results in double precision.
Thanks.
Double precision in complex or real?
For wave functions, we use complex. For quantum circuit simulations, we use complex. for quantum chemistry calculations, we use real.
Right, so like with the circuit simulation, you lose like a factor of 10 because the matrices are complex, factor of 11?
No, so the complex costs you 2 times more compared to real. The question before was about single versus double precision. The factor 11 is single versus double precision. For single and for double precision, you have then real or complex. That's another axis.
Can you also do sparse matrix multiplication on TPUs?
Very good question. That's the simple answer is no, or you can, but what's the MXU is going to take your sparse matrix and put all the zeros explicitly and boom. So yes, you can do it. but yes, sparse, so there is a sparse unit in the on each core now that tries to handle partially sparse multiplications, sparse matrix multiplications, but that's not where you want to be using a TPU.
I feel like you're the teaser on the biggest DMRG calculation. Are you going to show us what you calculated? The world's greatest
long dimension.
This one?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Okay, so this was a square lattice, 10 times 10. And 20 times 20 for rising model and for spinless fermion. So it was, you know, challenging from a perspective of the MRG. For the rising model, we have it's a criticality. For the free fermions, this was with a Fermi surface. So it's one of the more challenging type of systems from the perspective of the MRG, right? Because there are violations of the area law. So the bond dimension needs to grow very fast.
I guess there's an online question. Maybe, I don't know, can you just ask through your mic?
Is there an online question?
I guess it was Josh.
Okay.
Oh, one more.
So does anyone use this quantum chemistry stuff?
So, not besides us, and the software is in some strange state that probably cannot be used anymore.
I see.
Yeah, it's been now almost a year. It's going to be a year by the end of this year, and that we've not been able to access or upgrade the software. The team has been disbanded. So good luck. Good luck. Yeah. But we demonstrated that it's in principle possible.
And if I want to go online and like have my own TPU project, like how many cores can I access? It's just a joke.
So that's a good question. Actually, if you want to play around with TPUs, it turns out, do you know about Colab? Colab is like IPython. So in principle, you should be able to access TPUs for free, up to 8 cores with Colab. I haven't done it externally for a while, but I know that's possible.
Can you simulate Google's quantum supremacy experiment with TPUs?
And lose my job? So we could reach 40 qubits. Now with the latest generation of TPUs, probably 42 qubits.
Okay.
With NVIDIA's latest super pot of DGX nodes, blah, blah, maybe 45, 46 qubits, but not 53.
But there's no tricks you can pull because there's only like the 0.1% threshold for accuracy. Because that's how his research was working.
Yes. I would think that if we wanted, we could try to leverage TPUs to accelerate the type of simulations or tensor network contractions that go into simulating supremacy experiments. That would be a lot of work. And after working very hard on those applications and seeing how the team did not survive, I would think twice before trying. But it's true that in principle, you should be able to do that. Since the bottleneck of these tensor network contractions that go into simulating the supremacy experiment, the bottleneck is again massive tensor multiplications or matrix multiplications.
Okay, maybe it's a good time to call it. Let's thank Ifri again.
Thank you.